telecommunications, we are made very aware of how torn the world really is. But it's also Christmas, and Christmas celebrates God's love for humanity. By becoming a human being, he confirmed his love for us. And sometimes when we see these global problems that we really have very little ability to influence and change, it's important to remember the very personal aspect of God's love. So today's sermon is going to focus on this very personal aspect of God's love as each of us walk with him. We're going to begin by, Alf is going to play a song called Breath of Heaven, and the lyrics are going to be projected. We're not going to sing this song. This is a song for us to listen to. Amy Grant wrote this song, and in it she tries to capture what that long journey was for Mary. I find it to be a very powerful song, so I just want everyone to listen to it. And then when it's done, I'm going to read you a story with the help of Shoshi, my assistant. I'm going to read you a story which I call a Jerusalem Christmas story. This is a true story. Okay, thank you, Alf.
I have traveled many moonless nights, cold and weary, with a babe inside, and I wonder what I've done. Holy Father, you have come and chosen me now to carry your son. I am frightened by the load I bear in a world as cold as stone. Must I walk this path alone? Be with me now. Be
Remember, breath of heaven is a metaphor for Spirit of God. A Jerusalem Christmas story, a true story. Part 1, Conception.
Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Look, the young
Gentile Christian family were expatriates who had lived in the Holy City, in the Holy Land, for nearly 5 years. The father was working on his PhD at Hebrew University, finest among all universities in the world, to study ancient Semitic languages. The mother worked as an administrative assistant at a growing Christian congregation in Jerusalem. Their firstborn, a son, was 3 years old and attended a neighborhood Israeli daycare where he was becoming increasingly fluent in Hebrew. They lived on a modest budget in the married student housing on Mount Scopus, experiencing the daily joys and struggles of life in the land. Meeting Jews and Christians from diverse backgrounds, they experienced ever more deeply the richness of the Jewish background of their faith, which came alive in the unique environment of Jerusalem. The pregnancy was off to a good start. The due date was January 10th, 1988. Part 2, Crisis.
And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. Job 30:16.
Early June 1987 saw an outbreak of rubella at the daycare center. The young son broke out in a rash and ran a slight fever. As the mother cared for him, she reflected on how close her contact was with her son and what a significant exposure she had to the virus. However, she knew that you could only have rubella once. She and her husband had undergone all the required blood tests in their home state before their marriage. Evidently, she had had rubella as a child, since their physician had not advised her to be vaccinated against it. In any case, when she took her son to the pediatrician, who confirmed his diagnosis, she discussed the situation with the doctor. "I am pregnant in the first trimester. Before I got married, I had a blood test to confirm that I have antibodies against rubella. Do I have anything to worry about? Is this pregnancy at risk?" "No," the doctor affirmed. "If you've had rubella, you can't get it again. Your unborn child should be safe." 21 days later, the mother awoke with a spreading rash, swollen glands, aching joints, and fever. Her heart sank as her husband hurriedly brought her to the student health services. The medical staff heard the story. They expressed their discomfort at her presence at the clinic, where other young, possibly pregnant females might be put at risk. They said that it appeared to be rubella, but that diagnosis could only be confirmed on the basis of additional blood tests. Visual confirmation of symptoms alone was not sufficient. The first blood test was carried out on the spot to provide a baseline of rubella antibodies. The second blood test would be made 1 week later. If the antibodies had increased in number, the diagnosis would be confirmed. Should it be rubella, they added, then the student health services would, of course, cover the costs of the necessary abortion, which was medically indicated. Part 3, Despair and a Word from the Lord.
An angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." Matthew 2:13.
The young couple was devastated. How could this focus of joy and hope, this precious child in the womb, be at risk? How could a decree of death have been given so suddenly to the promise of life? It was a long week of waiting, waiting for the illness to run its course, waiting to take a second blood test to confirm what they already knew in their hearts. Seeking information about the possible outcomes, the mother called the pediatrician once again. She explained that she likely had rubella and was in the third month of her pregnancy. She said that the student health services were recommending an abortion. If so, could that possibly be the only choice? What would the pediatrician recommend? The pediatrician, a Jewish woman of deep religious conviction, said she would read from her textbook the possible outcomes for the baby from exposure to rubella in the first trimester.
Rubella in a pregnant woman can cause congenital rubella syndrome, with potentially devastating consequences for the developing fetus. Children who are infected with rubella before birth are at risk for growth retardation, mental retardation, malformations of the heart and eyes, deafness, and liver, spleen, and bone marrow problems.
The pediatrician agreed with the clinic staff. Since no medical test existed to determine if the child had been affected by the disease, rubella in the first trimester warranted an abortion without question. Stunned, the couple turned once again to prayer. As the days passed and the husband cried out to God on behalf of their child, the breath of heaven gently blew. The Spirit of God spoke, "You must protect the child from the doctors." What a paradoxical word to have impressed upon him. In general, one always trusts the doctors. Doctors are sworn to preserve and protect life. He shared this word with his distraught wife. They discussed what it might mean to have a disabled child. They knew that the command to protect the child did not guarantee that the child would not be affected in some way by the virus. They realized that in choosing not to abort the baby, they were committing themselves to the prospect of a lifetime of caring for a profoundly handicapped individual. Their belief in the value of all human life, whether of fit mind and body or not, was being put to the test. Could they commit to a drastically changed future, one that could be and would be highly shaped by caring for a disabled child? Together they hid the word in their hearts like iron to strengthen them for the long road ahead. The second blood test was taken as the wife was ushered in and out of the health clinic in haste so that no one else might be exposed to the virus. A few days later, the results were in. Rubella, without question. The clinic staff suggested scheduling the abortion once the wife was completely well and no longer contagious. The couple took a deep breath and told the staff that they would not have an abortion. The staff was stunned and patiently made every effort to be sure the couple understood the possible outcomes of the disease and the lifelong consequences of such a decision. The couple remained resolute. Part 4, Summer and Fall, The Long Road. Once she had recovered from her illness, the mother made monthly prenatal visits to the student clinic. At each visit, a new doctor from the rotational staff greeted her. The encounter followed a predictable pattern. The doctor would open the file, read the history, see the diagnosis and exclaim, "But you had rubella. You should have an abortion." Beleaguered, the mother would muster her courage to share the commitment of her and her husband to the life and welfare of the child, regardless of the outcome. It was a tiring encounter as the doctor resigned himself to a medical decision of which he did not approve and then proceeded to check blood pressure, weight gain, and the other quantifiable factors of pregnancy. No positive words, No encouragement, just disapproval.
Comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. Isaiah 40:1-2.
Only once did the encounter unfold differently. At that meeting, a new doctor, one wearing a kippah, opened the file and began reading. His eyes ran down the page. She could see the moment when he read the dreaded word. He paused for just a second, kept on reading, looked up, smiled, and said, "Okay, let's check your blood pressure." How grateful she was for that moment of kindness, for that unspoken acceptance by him of what he undoubtedly knew was a difficult decision, but a decision perhaps he would have made in a similar situation. How much she appreciated being treated like just another pregnant woman, and for being allowed to have hope and joy in the pregnancy.
And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. Job 30:16.
Without family in Jerusalem, they told almost no one of their situation. Why burden anyone else with circumstances that could not be changed? However, the burden was heavy and not to be carried alone. They found comfort and support from the pastors of their congregation, who came alongside them in prayer and with words of encouragement throughout the long months.
Weeping may linger for the night, but joy comes in the morning. Psalms 30:5.
The nights were long throughout that pregnancy. Falling asleep was difficult, as doubts and fears would especially manifest themselves in the dark just before sleep. Would the baby be well? Were they equal to the task? What did the future hold? O Lord, have mercy. O Lord, be our comforter. How hard it was to set aside fear. How hard to embrace hope. How difficult to trust that all would be well and that joy would come with the baby's arrival.
How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good tidings, who publishes peace, who brings good tidings of good, who publishes salvation, who says to Zion, "Your God reigns." Isaiah 52:7.
Summer passed, autumn arrived. As the pregnancy progressed, the clinic staff informed them that since the child was at risk, especially for heart defects, a special ultrasound would be made during the 8th month of the pregnancy. At the time, only 2 doctors in Jerusalem were able to operate the special machine that could perform an ultrasound on the chambers of the heart of a child still in the womb. An appointment was set up, and the couple drove to the city on the hill that is Hadassah Hospital, Ein Kerem. The doctor was an Orthodox Jew. When he learned the circumstances of the threat to the child, he compassionately said that not only would he check the heart, but he would systematically check every organ and aspect of the child's development to ascertain, to the degree possible, any damage or defect the baby might have suffered from exposure to rubella. As he measured and checked the chambers of the heart, every vital organ and eye sockets, he asked whether they would like to know the gender of the child. They said yes, and learned that they were having a girl. A wave of joy and anticipation swept over them. This was mixed with comfort at the positive assessment given by the doctor. All looked well, normal, and on schedule. They returned to the car and discussed what to name the baby. It was the first typical expecting parents conversation that they had had in a long time. They quickly agreed on the name. Part 5, Winter, the Birth.
While they were there, the time came for her to deliver the child, and she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger. Luke 2:6-7.
Winter came, and with it the celebration of Christmas, which fell on a Friday that year. The small family was invited to join friends on Mount Zion for Christmas dinner. The baby was near term, the due date just 2 weeks away. Christmas dinner was delicious, and the fellowship warm, relaxed, and encouraging. During the evening, the young mother began to experience contractions. She mentioned them to her hostess and laughed, saying they were undoubtedly Braxton Hicks contractions, commonly known as false labor. However, as they made their way to the car, she felt something more intense and said to her husband that perhaps this really was labor. How could this be? 2 weeks early. She hadn't even packed a bag yet or lined up anyone to stay with their son when they had to go to the hospital. They just weren't ready. Not ready for the small things, let alone the great. Her husband advised her to rest and see if the contractions would diminish. But as she lay in bed in the dark, the situation became clear. The baby was on the way. They called a friend to come and stay with their son. And although they lived in the student housing right next to the hospital, they drove the short distance to Hadassah Mount Scopus because it was just too painful to walk. It was shortly after midnight when they arrived. The hospital was quiet. The special peace of Shabbat had descended. The young mother brought the medical history with her and gave it to the attending midwives. She was surprised at their response. Their faces reflected no apprehension or concern. They prepared for the delivery as though this was just another routine arrival. Sometime around 5 a.m. in a quiet delivery room in Jerusalem, on the night after Christmas, the little girl was born, delivered by the compassionate Jewish midwives. She arrived without fanfare, and more importantly, without a trace of any problem whatsoever. She was perfect. She was beautiful. She cried for a few moments, was cleaned and wrapped in a receiving blanket, and laid in a crib, where she settled down for a long winter's nap. If ever there had been a moment of exhilaration, of relief, of joy unspeakable, of gratitude to God for his faithfulness and protection, it was this sacred moment. The utter quietness of that moment, surrounded by God's love, seeing his provision in a newborn life delivered by true mothers in Israel, dispelled months of uncertainty and fear. A new life had been brought into this world, and a future opened before it, unfettered, full of limitless possibilities, and awaiting God's direction. Hallelujah, rejoice. Part 6, Postscript.
There was no place for them in the inn. Luke 2:7.
The sun rose. The midwife wheeled the new mother down the hall to the maternity ward. The ward nurse rushed over and angrily berated the midwife, telling her that there were no beds available at all. The ward was completely full. The poor midwife was mortified at the insensitivity of the exchange and tried to shush the ward nurse. After all, the mother had just given birth, and a bed simply had to be found. Little did the midwife know that the frustration and yelling of the ward nurse could not begin to penetrate the sheer joy, the ecstasy of God's presence and provision. A bed would be found, she was sure. God had taken care of the major thing. A bed was a trifle compared to a life.